Okay. So I'm going to give a review for the our group on the Beast and Boost programs. It involves a number of different institutions, which are listed here, and I probably forgot some, but didn't bother writing names because I knew I would offend somebody. So better to offend everybody than someone in particular. B stands for the Background Emission Anisotropy Scanning Telescope. We thought of the acronym first and then decided what the experiment would be, which is typical in our group. And BOOST stands for Bolometers on BEAST. BEAST is appropriate for the instrument. It's a 2.2 meter diameter carbon fiber reinforced off-axis Gregorian telescope. So it's larger than Planck by a considerable amount. It consists of different types of detectors. The BEAST set of detectors uses a focal plane of high electron mobility transistors, basically the type that we're going to fly on Planck at 30, 40, and about 100 gigahertz. They're cooled to roughly 15 Kelvin via a gas cooler with a liquid helium storage tank. And there's a 2.5 meter nutating flat that gives us this unique two-dimensional scanning strategy, which gives us a very well interconnected data set. Beam sizes are approximately 27 arc minutes at 30 and 9 arc minutes at 90 gigahertz. Telescope was initially designed for both an LDB and what I call an SDB, short duration ballooning. It also can be used on the ground due to the way it's set up. It's a lot like the ACME series of payloads that we flew over the last decade, but it has a much larger aperture. It's a test bed for some of the Planck technologies, including the indium phosphide mimic amplifiers that are being used on Planck. The mirrors and optics are very similar. The feed horns are prototypes for Planck, and the back-end data acquisition may be a prototype for Planck, depending on which way we go. Okay. BOOST uses the same optics, but without the nutating flat. It also has a Planck blowdown single-stage 0.1 Kelvin dilution refrigerator that cools the focal plane. Beam sizes are down to about 4 arc minutes at 220 gigahertz. And this is designed primarily for smaller-scale SC measurements as well as anisotropy, and it's also designed for both short-duration and long-duration ballooning. It's a summary of the types of detectors that we have on board for BEAST. There's what are called KAQ and W-band. For those of you not familiar, is 30, 40, and roughly 100 gigahertz. The frequency is given there. We can reorient the focal plane depending on the particular experiment, but the rough sensitivity per single horn is of the order of 250 microkelvin or 300 microkelvin at Q-band and roughly 500 or a little bit worse in W-band. That's per horn, and then you get to divide by the square root of the number of horns. For the BOOST case, the frequencies are roughly 90, 150, 220, and about 400 gigahertz, and there we're assuming a relatively modest sensitivity, 150 microkelvin root seconds in the horn with the beam sizes shown, and this is operating at 0.1 Kelvin. Huh? Oh, close enough. They're about 25% bandwidth, roughly. Yes, it's CMB. Yeah. So it's fairly conservative compared to, for example, what you achieved in the last flight where you got below 100. So I think that's a conservative estimate. This is a chart of the number of pixels that we can achieve for a given flight with different scenarios, and you don't have to memorize it, obviously, but one can achieve up to something of the order of, if we could configure it for the ULDB option, which was the initial driver for this program, one can conceivably get 10 million pixels. Even in the LDB case, one gets up to about 6 million pixels. So it's definitely a large format mapping mission. The kind of power spectrum reconstruction, in theory, that could be done is shown here. This is for 8 hours, a 48-hour flight, which would be like a long turnaround flight, and then an LDV flight. And as you can see, a single flight in any of these configurations gives excellent science. In particular, a 15-day flight for boost would give just incredible reconstruction of the power spectrum. The parameter estimates are shown here. They're very good. If you compare this, for example, with Planck and MAP, as we all know that are in the business, you can do extremely well from a balloon compared to, at least compared to MAP. Planck will, of course, do significantly better. Other types of science one can get is there's a number of radio galaxies and infrared sources that we can go after, and these are estimates based on Toffolotti et al., depending on whether it's an 8-hour, 48-hour, 15-day, or in the ULDV case. There's quite a few sources that one can see. Just more parameter estimates. Okay, what makes East unique is really interconnection of the beam pattern. The fact that we can have a two-dimensional connection and then raster scan back and forth on the sky allows the reconstruction of the data to be much cleaner than you can otherwise. And what we show here, for example, is a simulated input map and then output maps depending on what the 1 over F noise spectrum is of the amplifiers. And this is for the beast case, where the 1 over F noise of the amplifiers run in a total power mode is fairly high. So we assume 50 hertz, 150, and 300 hertz, depending on the type of instrument. For the Q-band amplifiers, it's between roughly 50 and 100 hertz. And so you can see you reconstruct very well because of the two-dimensional nature of the interconnections. This is a schematic of the instrument. I'll show you a picture of it. You can see the large nutating flat. There are two mirrors. This is a smaller secondary mirror, and then the upper 2.2-meter carbon fiber mirror is here, radiator panels. It's like a small spacecraft. This is what it looks like out in the field in Fort Sumner before the ground shields are put on. You can see the flat here. You can see the storage tank, and the detector module is here. Okay, here's a better picture of the flat and the primary mirror up top. The flat spins at altitude, should spin at about 5 hertz. This is a picture of the focal plane array for the Q and Ka band focal plane. This feeds right into the secondary mirror. The HEMPs are down here, for those of you that are interested. It can be. There is an OMT on one of the horns. We have two OMTs that we could put in. At the moment, there's just one OMT put in. They're inherently polarization sensitive since they run single mode, as you know. This is a picture of the dilution refrigerator wired up to the cryogenic stage. The dilution head is up here. You can see the coiled loops over there. Anyone's interested in seeing it sometime, let us know. This is some data taken on the ground before flight, just pulling out the moon as it drifts through the beam. You can see the beam, in this case one beam, is moving, and then we raster scan slightly in azimuth back and forth. And as you can see, you can reconstruct point source quite nicely. You can actually see the profile on the moon. Our initial target was going to be the NCP, and this is just a map that should be familiar with what the galactic emission looks like at the NCP, which is not a fantastic region to look at, although it has other advantages in terms of its geometry. But at least at Q-band, at 40 gigahertz, we can get down to galactic measures which are acceptable. One issue which is important for all these experiments is how uniformly you cover the sky. This is, for example, a map, a simulated map for the Gamma Ursa Minoris region for 8 hours. And as you can see, this is time per pixel. There's quite a variation. And this is inherent in any of the missions where you have to scan across the sky like this. There's a picture out in our parking lot. You can see a little better the primary mirror to scale. Okay, this gives you a sense of how big the instrument is. I'm sorry, say again?
Do you re-image the feed axis on the fiber?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's a Gregorian situation. This is looking from on top the staging building in Fort Sumner. The payload is very long when you include the ground shield, so it's can be quite unwieldy. The total length from the launch pin out to the apex of the ground shield is in excess of 25 feet. So it's a large payload. This is another view looking at it at night. You can see the ground shield edge and the primary just sticking up above here. When it's normally observing, the ground shield is up, so you wouldn't be able to see the primary. This was just before launch recently. There was solar panels on the back for testing for the LDB configuration, and it doesn't look quite so large when it's stuck up against a 100-ton crane, but it's still pretty big. Well, I actually shouldn't show that first. This is what happened when it came down the ground. Luckily, or miraculously, we flipped over and landed on our back, which should be the case, although you don't assume it's going to happen, but it should be the case based on the balance of the instrument. It's very back-heavy. And basically nothing was seriously damaged. This is folded back up and put into the bin. So, unfortunately, during the flight, we had a separation of the flat surface, and so we're putting it back together to refly again. So we should have some more data, hopefully, this fall. Okay. Any questions? Yep. How much does it weigh? It weighs about 3,500 pounds. Yeah. Yeah, it's a biggie. Hmm? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's just at the limit for an LDB flight. Yeah. It's right at the maximum. Yeah. Somehow they all come in right at the maximum. I don't know how it happens. But. Okay, yeah. Yeah, so we're just... Right. So we've been in a rush to reconstruct the instrument rather than analyze the data, so it's been a bit of an issue. In fact, we'll love to sit down and talk with you since you're nominally signed up to help do that. this guy too. So we haven't had as much chance to look at that as we need to because we've been in a rush to actually reconstruct it fairly quickly. But unfortunately, the flat delaminated about 30,000 feet on ascent, and so it prevented any high altitude data from being taken. Okay, we have a lot of data taken on the ground, which actually looks very good. Fort Sumner is about 4,000 feet, and why you wouldn't imagine using that as an observing site, the instrument worked quite well even from Fort Sumner. Now, it's not probably going to be the quality that one's going to want to publish CMB data, but actually it looks pretty decent. So we'll see. We probably want to talk to you about that. Well, for Q-band, the 1RF need on the HEMS is about 100 hertz or so, between 50 and 150 hertz. These are direct detection. W-band, it's actually a real problem because in W-band for Planck, the 1RF need for the mimics is running in excess of 2 kilohertz if you run total power, and so it's deaf. And so for W-band, we're putting together Planck correlation receivers. So it'll be basically the Planck focal plane in W-band that will, or similar, that will be fine. No, the K and Q are being run total power. The W that we're putting together now are being run as correlation receivers. Okay, the 1RF need is just too high. Pardon? Yeah, although it's actually not as bad as you might think because we can show you the design we have. It actually is a very compact module since we had some time to readjust. So. Any other? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, you mean in terms of flying again?
Yeah.
Ballooning is only mentally insane people do ballooning. Okay, and so there's not a long queue. So it's not one of those things where you have millions of people waiting to fly. Most people have more sense than we do, so. Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, in fact, talking the other day, so yeah, sure, come on down, you know, we'll accommodate you. More the merrier, so. Okay.